May it please the court. The district court here applied a crime of violence enhancement that more than doubled the guidelines range. And the government, in its briefing, does not dispute that it was an error to do so. This court should grant relief so that Mr. Gutierrez can be resentenced based on the correct guidelines range. The error in this case was based on a straightforward principle of law. Crimes that require only a mens rea of recklessness do not qualify as crimes of violence under the force clause. Virtually every circuit, including this one, has applied that principle, and the government still has not cited any conflicting authority on that point. The Ninth Circuit applied this recklessness principle to the very statute at issue here, California Penal Code Section 246, and concluded that because that offense requires only a mens rea of recklessness, it does not qualify as a crime of violence under the immigration guideline.
Did you point that out to the district judge?
Your Honor, we concede that this is under plain error review. Absolutely.
So if it's so obvious, why didn't you point it out?
Well, Your Honor, the standard under plain error review isn't whether it's so obvious that it was pointed out. If that were the standard, you could never get relief on plain error review. The standard is whether after you identify the error, is it one that is clear or obvious? And here it is, in light of this unanimous authority across every circuit court, has applied this principle, and including this court in the Bayranu and Garcia cases, applied this recklessness principle to the provisions of 18 U.S.C. Section 16. That's the same principle that the Ninth Circuit applied with respect to this particular statute. And for that reason, I think there is the consensus across the circuit shows both that there was an error here and that it was a plain error.
Why would it be plain when the statute speaks in terms of willfully and maliciously shooting into an inhabited dwelling? I mean, you know, regardless of whether it's error or not, when the language of the statute itself speaks of an inhabited dwelling and a willfully and malicious shooting, that's the point. Now, you know, I know all the arguments that, well, this is recklessness, but it does say willfully and maliciously, and say, well, under the force clause, this is not directed at a particular individual, the person of another, and I understand all those arguments, but the arguments on one side of a case. It should have been brought up before the district judge.
Your Honor, again, we certainly concede this was an error that was overlooked by counsel, overlooked by the probation office, by the other parties. Everybody missed it. And that's why we're here under plain error review. We can see that. We don't attempt to make any argument that it's anything more than that. But the reason you look beyond the label in the statute, which I agree the California statute itself says willful and malicious in it, but there's consensus, again, in the Supreme Court and across every circuit that we don't simply defer to the labels on statutes. We look to how they're construed in the state courts and the elements as they're applied in the state courts. When you do that analysis here, the conclusion is inevitable, it's clear, it's plain, it's obvious that this isn't a crime of violence under this court's case law and under the case law in every circuit court across the country.
The adversary process supposed to do some work here?
Again, I mean, we concede it was plain error. It absolutely should have been pointed out. And
the district court needs help from the lawyers, and you've got the Supreme Court's opinion in Gall and subsequent cases saying that trial courts are really the key players in the sentencing process. And I would suspect that that would lead you to believe that reversals on plain error with the question of whether the predicate California crime was a crime of violence were never even raised before the trial court, that would be to avoid situations like this where, you know, the matter could have been disposed of, perhaps in your favor, but it just seems to me that you're asking for something that goes against the normal way in which sentencing and sentencing appeals are expected to proceed. We haven't even gotten to the fourth prong. I'm just talking about given the language on the face of the statute. I read the opinions as you're saying they're all so clear. Seem to me to be spraying all over the place, and many of the things that are argued about in supplemental authority came down after the district court made its decision.
Well, Your Honor, a couple of points on that. First, under the Henderson decision from the Supreme Court last year, those subsequent cases, even though they're after the district court's decision, are nonetheless factored in the analysis of whether the error is plain. But I want to go back to your other point about the central importance of the district court's role in the sentencing process. I actually think that's a key reason why the court should remand here for resentencing, so that the court can exercise its discretion under a correct calculation of the guidelines range. And the government argues that, you know, even if it is plain error, well, the district court went above the guidelines range based on the 3553A factors, so you should deny relief. But I think the court should reject that position. But just
that rationale for remand would sort of wipe out Olano, because we could say in every instance we should remand a case so that it can be an error-free proceeding and done under the correct way. So, I mean, that the rationale you've given me would just undercut the whole reason.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it would undercut Olano, because there are four prongs for Olano. There's no doubt that plain error relief is going to be atypical or unusual, but the first two prongs of Olano, whether there's an error and whether it's as plain and obvious where you have a consensus across the circuits as in this case, are going to do a lot of work in most cases. So when you get to the third prong, I think the Seventh Circuit is right to recognize, especially in light of the Supreme Court's decision last year in Pew, that an error in calculating the guidelines range impacts a person's substantial rights. I think here we can show the same thing that was shown in Slade, where this court remanded on plain error review based on an error that was acknowledged by the court and granted resentencing in that case. I think here the sentence relief is even more justified than in Slade. If you just compare the magnitude of the error, in Slade, this court granted plain error relief based on a 3-level increase in the offense level.
Mr. Perlmutter, I would think your initial problem, and perhaps your only problem in this case, is the clarity of the error. I don't know that the magnitude really affects too much the plain error analysis, at least in my mind. And so we don't have Fourth Circuit prior precedent interpreting this statute, right?
Your Honor, I disagree with that. I think if you look at the Garcia case, Garcia versus Gonzalez, it says it's interpreting Section 16A of Title 18, which is the same force clause that applies under Section 2L1.2. And when it interprets that, it says that what we are dealing with there, a reckless assault, does not qualify under 16A because, quote, it does not contain an element that there be the intentional employment of physical force against a person or thing. Here, we don't have that. We don't, just as in Garcia, we don't have a statute that requires the intentional employment.
Immigration cases, we don't always just transpose.
Your Honor, Leocal was an immigration case, and the Supreme Court very clearly said there that the same language has to be interpreted consistently, whether in the immigration context or in the criminal context. That's why you see a footnote in Leocal which says that even if there were some ambiguity here, we would have to apply.
Had a chance to consider the argument about whether a transposition was possible or not. It was never brought before.
Again, I absolutely agree that this is under a plain error analysis, but
we've got a case, U.S. v. Knight, where there was a miscalculation of a sentence, and there was a downward variance in that case. Mm-hmm. There's an upward variance in this case. And the court held in that case that that defendant's substantial rights were not affected. Why wouldn't the analysis be the same, whether you're over or under the guidelines?
I think I'm aware of the Knight case, Your Honor, and I think the difference, the first key difference with Knight is the magnitude of the error. And I agree with Judge Motz that the magnitude might not have any impact on whether the error is plain. I think it does factor into the calculus in terms of whether it affects substantial rights and whether it warrants this court's exercise of its discretion under plain error review. In Knight, it was only a two-level error in the guidelines, and the sentence that was imposed was nonetheless still below the what would have been the correct guidelines range. And so for that reason, I think it's very different than here, where you're dealing with a seven-level increase, not a two-level increase. You're dealing with a situation where the error resulted in increasing the guidelines range by approximately 125 to 140%.
You make it seem like this is some great injustice, but the I've read the sentencing transcript with care. I think the district court's going to arrive at the same conclusion no matter what. He's very emphatic about this whole matter, and he talks about says, I look at this file and I see a defendant who has, after his deportation, has returned to this country on six occasions, been removed on six occasions, has a criminal record that includes drug convictions, convictions for indecent exposure, for obstruction of justice, for theft on several of these occasions. He's returned here very quickly after having been deported. That's just the tip of the iceberg. This district court speaks this pattern of being deported and returning. And with almost every one of these returns, there being additional crimes on the criminal history. You read that sentencing transcript.
Your Honor, I absolutely agree that Judge Reininger made clear his reasons for varying upward here. But the problem is that I'll concede that apart from the error in the guidelines calculation, Judge Reininger got the process part right. What he did is just what the Supreme Court says you're supposed to do in the Pugh case, which is he calculated the guidelines range. He just got it wrong because we didn't point it out, and we concede that. And he then used that guidelines range as the jumping off point. He said, look, I think there's a factor in this case, the fact that he's been in and out of the country all these times, that's not accounted for in the way that the guidelines are calculated. There's no specific offense characteristic that takes into account deportations and returns that aren't prosecuted criminally. He said, because of that, I think the way the guidelines work here, there's a factor that's missed under 3553A, so I'm going to vary above the guidelines. And he varied above by 70%. Had he done that exact same analysis, citing all the reasons that you cite and using the correct guidelines range, he would have ended up at a sentence of 36 months, which is less than half of the 78 months he imposed here.
We must not be reading the same sentencing transcript.
Mr. Governor, just before you sit down, maybe you can tell me the case that you think that is best for you, not on the underlying question of whether this is error, but has the same sort of confluence of no circuit precedent directly on point, transfer from one context to another context. And I understand that you say there's arguably no circuit split, but you've read the government's brief, you know what they say. So what other case would be similar to that and a record like this?
Well, there was a lot packed into that question.
Right, but I'm asking you to try to, in other words, I was trying to explain to you what I meant by your best case. So not your best case on whether this is error, but your best case on whether we should apply plain error review and grant you relief. And if you don't have, comes to common mind, that's fine.
Well, I think that there, on the question of applying interpretive principles from the immigration context here, I think Leocal is very clear on that, so that would be the best case. In terms of the broader question, I think the two cases I would point to are Slade, where there is where the court exercises its discretion under the third and fourth prongs of Olano based on a much less significant change in the guidelines range than is present here.
I don't think I've been clear. I was trying to find a case that had all of these elements, and I couldn't find one. And it doesn't seem to me that you're articulating one.
Well, I will agree. There's maybe not a case that's exactly like this one. I think
doesn't Cawthorn cut against you in this area because in that instance, the court declined to reverse because of the plain error standard and said, you know, where there's no circuit case on point and there's a split in the circuits, doesn't Judge Keenan's opinion there cut against you?
Well, I think it doesn't because there isn't a circuit split in this case, and because I think the Garcia case and the Bayranu case.
Disagree on that point.
Well, I mean, I give Mr. Miller credit for coming up with something that at least on its surface looks like a circuit split. But when you dig below the surface in Martinez, and Curtis, those two statutes differ in a material respect that absolutely explains the different outcome in those cases. There's the government, I'm sure if there were one out there, the government would have found a case that declines to extend Leocal's holding to recklessness cases. There's not a case like that out there.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Mr. Miller.
May it please the court, my name is William Miller. Here on behalf of the government. Because the defendant is unable to cite to any binding authority addressing a statute making a crime like this one, he's unable to satisfy his burden establishing plain error review.
The government concedes that there was error, correct?
The government, I don't concede that there
was error. Well, you make an argument in your brief that there's no error.
No, Judge Motz, I did not.
So don't you think that argument is foreclosed now? You can't come up here on appeal and say there isn't any error if you've never made the argument in your appellate brief.
That's likely correct, Your Honor.
You've listened to the earlier argument.
Yeah, by way of
seen you're giving up much. You know, prosecutors gain credibility by conceding what they must and moving on.
And I understand that fully.
I thought you made the point that you didn't need to get into it.
Correct. That's where I was headed, Judge Wilkinson, is this case doesn't require taking a position on error necessarily because any error in this case would not be plain because the defendant's unable to cite to any binding authority addressing a statute like this one. And I think it's important to understand at the outset what exactly this California statute requires. What this statute requires, as interpreted by the California courts, is the intentional firing of a gun. It requires general intent as to the consequences of hitting the building. And so it's different from the statutes that Mr. Carpenter relies on because unlike those statutes, which are essentially reckless battery statutes, they're recklessly causing some sort of harm. Here, the nature of the force is specified in the crime. It requires the intentional shooting of a gun, which is violent force. And so in that sense, it's distinguishable from the cases on which Mr. Carpenter relies where there is no discussion in the statute or element of violent force in the statute. Here, the willful employment of violent force is an element of the crime. And so even under Leocal, it satisfies that part of Leocal's holding. And no one would dispute that shooting a gun is violent force under the Supreme Court case in Johnson. And so that's really what we're dealing with here, is a crime that requires the intentional use of violent force with a general intent as to the consequences. And that issue has divided courts. And I would point the court to...
Does the force clause require, in your view, that you anticipate a specific consequence, that those words are against the person of another? Does it require that you intend to inflict force upon a particular person? Whereas if you're shooting into an inhabited dwelling, may or may not hit somebody or whatever. You could be just trying to shoot the window out, for example, rather than aiming at a particular person. Does that undercut your force clause argument? If you just don't like the people in the house, you don't want to hurt them necessarily, but you would like to just shoot out a window or mess up their door. Not that these are admirable behaviors, but I'm just wondering how that squares with against the person of another.
I think why
people are talking about recklessness.
Right, and in your hypothetical, Judge Wilkinson, I think that would at least constitute the threatened use of force because it is firing a gun at an occupied building or in close proximity to an occupied building. That would at least rise to the level of threatened force. And I would point the court's... I would draw the court's attention to the Tenth Circuit case in U.S. versus Ramon Silva, In that case, the court addressed a statute like this one that was a crime that required intentional force, but with only a general intent as to the consequences. And in that case,
intentional force, what I didn't hear the last part of the sentence.
With only a general intent as to the consequences, because that's what this California statute does. I mean, there's no dispute that this California statute has intentionally firing a gun as an element. The part where a lesser mens rea comes into play is really only as to the consequences. And that's the question that has divided courts. Mr. Carpenter has cited the Narvaez-Gomez case from the Ninth Circuit. But on the other side, you have a Tenth Circuit case addressing a very similar statute to this one. And in that case, the Texas statute says knowingly discharges a firearm at or in the direction of one or more individuals. That in the direction of is the same type of language that comes into play with the California statute, which says in close proximity to. There's not a specific intent that you have to make the hit, the consequence. And so in that case, the Tenth Circuit held that because the intentional force of violence is an element, the general intent as to the consequences, it still qualifies under the force clause. And so that's where the division really comes in. And that's why the cases that Mr. Carpenter relies on aren't informative of this question. Those cases are all about reckless batteries. They don't define the element of force. Here, the statute on its face and California courts say that this requires an intentional shooting, which is that's the violent force part. And so that's really where the split comes in. And then the Illinois statute that was addressed in the Curtis case by the Seventh Circuit, it functions the same way. Knowingly or intentionally discharges a firearm in the direction of a vehicle he or she knows or reasonably should know to be occupied by a person. It's the same as this California statute. You have intentionally firing the gun, and then it's in the direction of a vehicle. Here we have in close proximity to an occupied structure. And so it functions the same way, and the Seventh Circuit held that also was a crime of violence. And I think that the important part, this comes out of the Silva case, there was a dissent in that case, and the majority says the dissent focuses on what apprehension causing aggravated assault lacks as an element, namely the specific intent to induce the fear, which is the consequence. Missing from its analysis is a discussion of the intentional conduct that the crime actually prescribes. And so that's the same problem we're confronted with here. And so, you know, for those reasons, there truly is a split, and the immigration cases that the defendant cites from our circuit don't govern because the crime at issue is very different. And I would also point out that the fact that those cases arose under the immigration context is also important here, because although the force clause in that immigration context is the same, the definition doesn't function the same way.
Where do you get this in close proximity language?
That comes out of People versus Overman, which is the case that Narvaez-Gomez relied on when it found that this statute requires a lesser mens rea.
Okay.
And so that's...
It's certainly not in Section 246. Not in the...
It seems to me that you're over-arguing your case. I'm not sure I agree with just about anything you've said in the last 5 minutes, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I think there's no plain error here, so that maybe you could give me the essence of the argument that one has to follow to find there is no plain error, because maybe I've misunderstood what is required to find no plain error. If I have to buy your interpretation of all these cases, I'm not so sure.
Yeah, and I apologize for that. My point was just to sort of highlight that there was a bit of an overgeneralization in the defendant's argument. My argument is that any error here is not clear or obvious. That's what this court has to decide. And clear or obvious, the question is there binding authority from the Supreme Court or the Fourth Circuit addressing this issue? And the point I was making before
we
is really...
You don't have to buy your argument on the error part of it.
Correct.
I don't think we do, but I was just...
Correct. The only...
Thought that.
And it was, you know, not good strategy for me to start with that. The point of that discussion was just to show that courts are truly divided on this issue. But as to whether or not there's binding authority from the Supreme Court or the Fourth Circuit in this case, neither court has addressed this statute or one like it. And so that's the first part. And then the second part is that these cases on recklessness address a different type of statute than we're dealing with here and arise in a different context, the immigration context. And in the immigration context, Mr. Carpenter is correct to point out that this force clause uses the same language as the illegal reentry context, but the definitions are different in material ways. In the immigration context, the crime of violence definition is comprised of a force clause, where you have a crime with an element of force, and a residual clause. There's no list of enumerated offenses. And that's different from the illegal reentry context, where you have enumerated offenses and a force clause. And leading into that force clause, the language actually says, or any other crime that has as an element of force. And so, similar to the Supreme Court's analysis in Begay and Sykes, the second part of the definition refers back to the first. And when you look at that definition of enumerated offenses in the illegal reentry guidelines, you find a crime that has the same mens rea as the crime that we're dealing with here. And that's manslaughter. Manslaughter is a general intent crime, as this court has held in Peterson. And so the context matters, I guess, is the point that I'm trying to make. And those cases that the defendant relies on arise in a different context and address different kinds of crimes. And so they don't provide an answer to the question we're dealing with here. And so that's the government's argument, is that there's a lack of binding authority on this particular type of crime. Moving to whether to the third and fourth prongs of plain error review, that definitely presents a closer question as to whether or not the defendant has shown a substantial likelihood or a non-speculative basis that the sentence would be different. But I do think
the strength of your argument rely on the second and fourth prongs. Just leave the first and third prongs alone.
Right. It's
we only have to find, you know, we only have to find one of the prongs not satisfied. It's all plain error. You have to show that all four are met. It just seemed to me that your argument on prongs two and four was stronger than your arguments on one and three. That we didn't need to get into one and three, but if you only need to win on one prong.
That's right, and I would agree with your characterization, Judge Wilkinson.
The others are much closer questions.
Absolutely. The government does not deny that. But the second prong, I believe, in the absence of binding authority, is clearly in the government's favor. And as to the fourth prong, the question there is whether or not failure to address the error would call into question the fairness and integrity of judicial proceedings. And here, in light of the defendant's history and characteristics, as thoroughly explained by the district court, a 78-month sentence for a defendant like this one simply doesn't call those things into question. I mean, the court came very close to saying, you know, this is the sentence I'm going to impose regardless. I mean, it's somewhat of a unique sentencing hearing because defense counsel actually reopened the argument after the court had announced its sentence and called into question his sentence. And so the court continued, said, I want to make a good record for this, and continued to thoroughly explain his sentence. And so it wasn't a case where he said, you know, this is my sentence regardless of how any of the other issues come out, but it comes pretty close in light of the fact that they sort of reopened the analysis. And the court's discussion of the factors is spot on.
Pretty extensive discussion, and it's a pretty thoughtful discussion. I mean, it goes on for a number of pages, and it talks about respect for law and deterrence and the kind of 3553A factors you would expect, but it wasn't as if the district court just gave the whole thing the back of its hand. It didn't. I mean, you have a very good idea of why this sentence was imposed. In fact, it's repeated about three or four times.
Right. And a lot of that is by virtue of the fact that this defense counsel sort of reopened the argument. And I think the factor that the court found most significant is that the defendant had committed several illegal reentries and had been given a second chance, but rather than treating it, these are the words of the district court, rather than treating it as a second chance, he saw it as
he'd a... He already had the safety valve, the benefit of the safety valve provision earlier, hadn't he?
He had been fast-tracked several times before, and so he had little to no consequences for his prior illegal reentry crimes. And so that was really the factor that was driving the district court. And he
is
was.
Anything further you wish to add? Or let me ask my co-panelists if they have any
Thank you.
Thank you. We think we understand your argument. And Mr. Carpenter, let's hear from you in rebuttal.
I'll start back with the plainness issue. The government seizes now, sort of for the first time, I think, in the 28J letter on the fact that this California statute in Overman says that it requires intentional discharge of a gun, but then with reckless disregard for the consequences. That intent requirement isn't what we're looking for under Leocal. Under Leocal, and as it's been extended by this court in Bayrano and Garcia, what we require under the force clause is an intentional use of force against another person. And some intentional act somewhere along the way is not enough. And if you look at the facts of Leocal itself, it's a DUI where a person drives their car into someone and causes injury. Certainly the drinking and then the getting in the car and driving, all of those are intentional acts, but they're undertaken with reckless disregard for the safety of others. The same is true with the intentional discharge of a firearm. Here, there are many circumstances in which intentionally discharging a firearm is not directed against another person at all, at a firing range, while you're hunting, etc. What is required under the force clause is an intentional use of force against another person. That's what's missing here, and that's why the cases that the government cites as potentially creating some type of conflict don't really create a conflict. Because when you look, you know, Mr. Miller cited one of the cases where the person's required to fire at a person or at a vehicle in which they reasonably believe a person is located. That's very different from the statute here. If you look at the facts of People versus Overman, which the California courts held were sufficient to satisfy this statute, the defense theory there was, I fired the gun in the air. The court said, that's fine because you were in close proximity to a building. So the discharge of the firearm wasn't directed at a person. It wasn't even directed at a building. And to answer Judge Wilkinson's question, it's absolutely not enough under 2L1.2 if the use of force is directed against the building. Under 2L1.2, it requires the use of force against another person. In that sense, 2L1.2's force clause is narrower than the one in Section 16A. Also want to go back to the question of whether this court's precedent bears on this issue. And Bayrano and Garcia interpret Section 16A and Section 16B of Title 18. And granted, they do so in the immigration context, but in Leocal, the Supreme Court said that those provisions have to be interpreted consistently. If you look at page 11 of the Leocal decision, 543 U.S. 11, it specifically says the mens rea requirement in both 16A and 16B must be interpreted consistently. In those two cases, this court has extended Leocal to cover reckless offenses. And that principle that reckless offenses don't qualify under those provisions is uniform. I will concede that this court hasn't addressed this particular statute. So in that sense, sure, the error isn't that plain or obvious, but it doesn't need to be. The principle that
recklessness cases, your opponent made the point in response to what you said in your opening argument that the recklessness cases were cases of reckless battery. That were very different from the particular statute at issue here, which uses the words willfully and maliciously, which doesn't really convey recklessness. Now, you look at the California decision, I understand what they say about Section 246, but they are not... they're not to the point where they really are. The recklessness cases aren't really dealing with this kind of statute, are they? They're dealing with reckless battery.
Well, certainly some of them deal with reckless battery, but none of them are. They're not. Their reasoning certainly isn't limited to that circumstance, and nothing in it suggests that this is, and nothing would support the notion that you can have an offense by offense. Well, you require recklessness if it's battery, but if it's something else, we're going to require a different mens rea. The principle that that underlies the Leocal decision is that in saying that the crime must require the use of force, the natural reading of that is that it's the active, intentional use of force. This court has extended that in Bayrano and Garcia to say that that doesn't cover reckless uses of force. And here, that's what we're dealing with. I mean, the Ninth Circuit analyzed this very statute and rejected the very government argument that the government's making here. That makes the error plain. And if there is no conflicting authority on that point in any other circuit, and the reckless discharge or the intentional discharge statutes that the government cites are different in material ways. First, none of them deal with the same mens rea requirement that the California courts have imposed upon Section 246.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting argument, but normally one would expect a district court to look to controlling authority, and controlling authority is generally found in the Supreme Court and circuit court decisions behind the district court. Now, you say, well, the California Supreme Court is controlling authority. It's controlling authority as to that statute. But that's a different thing from being controlling authority in one's own circuit. And the district courts follow Fourth Circuit opinions. We hope they do. But they don't, they're not. I'm nervous about your idea that the people have to go roaming all over the country.
Well, I think that when you combine the Ninth Circuit case that deals with this particular statute and says it doesn't qualify based on this recklessness principle, and you combine that with this court's decision applying that very same recklessness principle, I think that makes the error plain. But I wanted to turn just for a second to Judge Floyd's question earlier about why to exercise discretion under the fourth prong here as compared to Knight. And I think one of the starkest illustrations of why it's warranted here is the disparity in the size of the sentence. In Slade, for example, where the court granted relief, the sentence was 39% above the top end of what would have been the correct guidelines range. Here, we're dealing with a sentence that is nearly four times the top end of the correctly calculated range and more than five times the low end of the guidelines range. That's an error that I think warrants this court's exercise of discretion. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We'll come down and greet you both and then adjourn in order to reconstitute the panel.
This honorable court will take a brief recess.